In this part of the show, we'll be talking about why it is that as we look around the world, we see such a big spread between the nations that are at the bottom, economically speaking, and those that are at the top. And our guest for the program is Jeffrey Sachs. He is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and is well known for advising governments around the world in Latin America, in Eastern Europe, and the former Soviet Union, Asia, Africa, on economic reforms, also for his work with international agencies to promote reduction of poverty, control of disease, and debt reduction of poor countries. He is the author of a book that we'll be talking about that has recently been published, and the title is The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. It's published by the Penguin Press. In the book, he makes the point that when we take a look at the global economy, there is some good news and some bad news. That the good news is that well over half of the world is experiencing economic progress. However, he adds, the greatest tragedy of our time is that one-sixth of humanity, roughly a billion people, are not even on the development ladder. However, again, going back to a piece of good news, he does in this book make the argument that it is possible to end extreme poverty within our generation. And in the book, The End of Poverty, he makes some suggestions on how it is we might do that. In addition to being director of the Earth Institute, he is also professor of sustainable development and professor of health policy and management at Columbia University. He is also director of the UN Millennium Project and is a special advisor to the UN Secretary General Kofi Annan on the Millennium Development Goals. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, at any point here, people are certainly welcome into the conversation. All we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep the program moving and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone is welcome to call. Dr. Sachs, hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Very good, thank you.
We appreciate you giving us your time. There are a lot of things that we can talk about here, and we'll try to hit the high points. And if people, of course, want greater depth, they're going to have to go and seek out the book and take a look at it. But I guess maybe as one basic question, I might have you talk a little bit about, before talking about the kind of approach that that you take, what we have done so far. And it's not as if we haven't tried. That is, the more developed nations of the world haven't tried over the last 50 years or so to aid those that are less well off. Why, the question then, I guess, would be, why is it that those efforts at aid have not been more effective?
Well, they have been effective. There's been a lot of development in the world, a lot of progress. Probably even more dramatic than the economics is the expansion of life expectancy and the reduction of child mortality rates in most of the world. And this is all very good news. The book is quite optimistic in the sense that economic development does work. But I do think we're getting to some of the hardest places on the planet when we talk about the poorest of the poor. These are places that have many disadvantages, not the ones that we might normally think about of whether bad politics or bad luck in history, not only those, but also problems of isolation. They're landlocked countries in the middle of Asia or Africa or South America, or they're very drought-prone regions where it's very difficult to grow enough food to keep ahead of hunger, or places burdened by massive disease pandemics like AIDS and malaria. So I would say that development has worked. Development assistance in many, many areas has worked. This bleak assessment that we give that it's all money down the drain is silly. It's just nonsense, because immunization rates and child survival and many, many things, literacy, have improved, and partly with the benefit of aid. But the point is, we shouldn't generalize. We should understand each region for its situation and for what it needs or doesn't need at the moment. And the point of the book is that there are a billion people on the planet who are facing risks of death every day because they are so poor that they are right on the edge of survival. And there are practical things that could be done and should be done to help those people too get on the path of economic development if we take this issue practically rather than ideologically.
And there, when we're talking, there are obviously different levels of poverty. We're talking about extreme poverty. These are people who live on less than a dollar a day.
The conventional definition of extreme poverty is this so-called dollar-a-day standard. It's a little bit misleading. Of course, people could understand intuitively that if you're earning less than a dollar a day, $365 a year of your income, you're doing pretty miserably. But it's actually not a great measure of what extreme poverty really is, because it's not just the income. It's a question, do you have safe drinking water available? Is disease running out of control? Is there emergency health care available when it's needed? Can the children go to school? And so a proper measure of poverty, of extreme poverty, in my view, is the question of whether people can meet the most basic needs that they have for adequate food intake, for safe drinking water, for basic prevention of disease, for basic health care when disease hits, for basic access to education. And the answer is, for the bottom sixth of the planet, decidedly not.
And I guess you also make I think in embedded in your first comments an important point. It's something that I think that you do try to get across in the book, and that is the idea is that if you look at a particular country and you ask what sort of problems does it have and what sort of aid might be appropriate, that you have to appreciate that any given country or any given region is complex. And the factors that might be most important one place might be different from the factors most important someplace else. And therefore, what works one place may not work in another. And it seems that there may be some general things you can say about overall strategy, but then you'd have to look at each place as an individual case.
You put it perfectly. It really drives me crazy, actually, that we treat this economic development issue a little bit like medicine was three centuries ago. You have a problem, put the leeches on the patient, drain them of blood, kill them half the time. So unscientific that you basically think that there are one or two or three causes of these problems, but economies are complex, development challenges are complex, you can't just assume that everything comes back to corruption or bad government or the need to privatize. But this so-called Washington consensus or structural adjustment era that the IMF and the World Bank led for a quarter century, really, from around 1980, almost till now, was based on the idea that you could do just a global replace, if you want, change the name of one country to the next and give the same prescriptions, pretty much a cookie-cutter approach, pretty much one problem. You ask somebody in Washington, why is Africa poor? Oh, I know, it's corruption. It's corruption. People don't even look. They don't know. They don't look. They don't get out of their offices in Washington. They don't go to the villages. They don't understand that it may be malaria running out of control. It may be the AIDS pandemic. It may be lack of ability to grow food because of soil nutrient depletion or drought. It may be the absence of proper infrastructure. And this failure to make what a medical doctor calls a differential diagnosis, term that I learned from my wife, who's a clinical pediatrician, who does a wonderful job of making a careful diagnosis among dozens or even hundreds of possible causes of a disease, or of a symptom, I should say. We don't do that in the world of development and the poor. We just tend to blame the poor for these problems and move right on in very simplistic logic, which then doesn't solve the problems of the toughest places.
My lines are full here, and I want to promise these people I get right to them. Just one other point that I think that it seems to me to be important, and I wanted to ask you to talk about here, and that is, if you look back, particularly, you look back a couple of 100 years, you see that it didn't have this kind of spread between rich and poor, because basically almost everybody was poor, and this is something that has happened again for a number of reasons: the Industrial Revolution, other key factors that enabled some countries to leap ahead. One thing that seems to be a fairly important point that you make, and indeed may get us into some controversy, is you make the argument that the rich nations did not get rich because the poor got poor. It was not a transfer of income. It was the fact that there was growth all over, but it was growth at dramatically different rates.
That's right. And it's a little bit complicated because I'm not saying that the rich treated the poor well or fairly. The rich exploited the poor. The rich invaded the poor. The rich ripped off the poor. But those are actually not the causes of the rich being rich. They're the result of the rich being richer and therefore more militarily powerful than the poor. And it's a little bit complicated. The point is that the total output in the world, both per person and, of course, in total amount, has risen spectacularly. We're able to produce a lot more than we were before the Industrial Revolution. It's the miracles of science-based technologies. It's now the miracles of the information age, but before it was the miracles of the chemical and electrical age, and before that it was the miracles of the steam age. And it was essentially those great technological breakthroughs, steam engine, steam power, factories based on fossil fuels, electrification, and now all the miracles of information communications technology, as well as biomedical technology. This is what led fundamentally to the rise of world income. Before 1800, when you didn't have these science-based technologies, you had the powerful exploiting the weak, but you didn't have economic development taking place anywhere, actually. You didn't have long periods of economic progress. So what happened was that based on science and technology, societies figured out how to harness fossil fuels. They figured out how to harness electricity and so forth. With that, economic development took place, but very, very unevenly. Those places that got ahead, basically Western Europe and the United States, well, they were able to exploit the ones that were left behind because of the vast difference of military power. It was not a pretty picture at all, but one shouldn't confuse the exploitation for the reason that the rich are rich today. That's basically because of the science and technology. Now, that's very good news in my view, because it says that if the fundamental reason for progress is ideas and technology and scientific knowledge, that's something that can spread to all parts of the world, and I do think that that really is the key.
Our guest, again, I'll introduce him and then we'll get to some callers here. Our guest is Jeffrey Sachs. He is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's also professor of sustainable development and health policy and management there at Columbia. In addition, he's a director of the UN Millennium Project and special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the Millennium Development Goals, and has for the last 20 years or so been spending time traveling around the world providing advice to governments in Latin America, Eastern Europe, Asia, Africa on economic reforms. And if you're interested in reading in greater depth some of his ideas, you can look for his book, The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. It's published by the Penguin Press. We have callers, and we'll take them in the order they came in, starting with someone in Kankakee on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Your caller is the same one who learned of Dr. Jeffrey Sachs' fine book, The End of Poverty, the simple statement of the message of which seems to be that appropriation of 0.7% of all gross national product to ending extreme poverty will accomplish the task by 2025. We learned of this in a brief notice in the Kankakee, Illinois newspaper, the Daily Journal, read the book and recommended the visit of Dr. Sachs to Focus 580. So welcome, Dr. Sachs, and
thank you.
WILL and David Inch. Your caller's not a Kinkian, but a Vonmesian, and wonders whether governments, non-governmental institutions, or charities, any of them, will produce the resolve needed to extreme poverty eradication, as do you. But book is an excellent tool, and your work is good, and your caller is listening with interest. Thank you for your excellent work and for Columbia University's Earth Institute. Good morning.
Thank you so much for the call.
And that is indeed, people often suggest to us topics and guests, and you were here because that gentleman said, why don't you have this guy on the show?
So wonderful. I appreciate that. I'm grateful. His question is about who can actually do this. Should it be governments? Should it be charities, NGOs, and so forth? A couple of points I would make. First, the recommendation of using 0.7% of the income of the rich world to end extreme poverty in the poorest of the poor is not a call for charity. This is not about handouts. This is about using those resources to invest in the poorest places on the planet so that those places can achieve economic development. There are, broadly speaking, three kinds of investments that I think are critical. Investments in people, meaning their education, their health, their nutrition, family planning also. Investments in their environment, water, soils, conservation measures, which are crucial for the poorest of the poor because they tend to be farmers. They live right off the land. And then investments in infrastructure, in roads, in power, in telecommunications, in internet connectivity, in ports and airports. So the key is to use that modest amount of income, less than 1% of the income of the rich world, to invest in the poorest of the poor so that the solution is a permanent one, not just a handout of food, but rather a permanent solution so that people can grow more food, so that they can make the transition to higher technology. Now, how can this be done? I think it can be done in many different ways, and I'll just briefly note that I was in Kenya a couple of days ago visiting a village where I'm working with my colleagues at the Earth Institute, a village described in the book, a village in western Kenya, where a very generous philanthropist said, I'd like to help that village escape from extreme poverty. I'll put in those investments in those three different areas, and at a cost of about $50 per person in the village, a village of 5,000 people, so a $250,000 per year investment, please help this village get out of extreme poverty. Now, the results are absolutely stunning. We've been working there just for a year, but I saw a wall of corn, 8 feet tall, beautiful crop that is 3 or 4 or 5 times larger than what this community has been growing in recent years because of simple investments in fertilizer, for example, in soil nutrients, in improved seeds, in a bit better water management. And lo and behold, this community in one planting season is going to escape from the extreme poverty that it found itself up until last year. I saw this community now with bed nets to fight malaria. The people could not have been more thrilled. $7 per net. We've enabled the community of this impoverished place for everybody to sleep under a bed net. They were so grateful. They said malaria is already coming down. They know it. They feel it. But they also said they could sleep at night because those mosquitoes are not buzzing around their heads anymore, and that this has improved the quality of life dramatically. Something so simple. A clinic. We helped them with some cement, some electrical wiring. They built themselves a clinic. We've helped them to hire a doctor. Well, it turns out simple, practical investments can change the lives decisively of very poor people. And this can be done through individual charitable giving. It can be done by communities here partnering with communities there, businesses taking on the challenge and saying, okay, we'll sponsor a village to help them get out of extreme poverty. And the UN Millennium Project, which I direct, stands ready to help anyone that wants to make that kind of direct investment in helping the poorest of the poor to get out of this mess that they're in.
I think, though, that you are, as the caller suggests, and one of the things that you are calling for is to, for the developed nations, the wealthiest nations, to be spending more in terms of international aid, foreign aid. How much, let us just take the United States. How much do we spend now, and what would you be suggesting in terms of an increase?
Terrific question. So right now, we spend $16 billion a year on fairly low-quality aid, and I'll explain why. Now, $16 billion should be compared with our annual income in this country, our so-called gross national product, which is $12 trillion. So it's 0.16% of our GNP. In other words, it's 16 cents out of every $100 of our GNP is used for development assistance, just 16 cents out of $100. But it's low-quality aid because more than half of that is going to a few war zone countries, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, Egypt, Palestine, Colombia, for the drug eradication. For help for the poorest of the poor in Africa, believe it or not, we're giving $2 billion this year for all of Africa, which comes out to 2 cents for every $100 of our GNP. You know, you constantly hear in this country, oh, I don't want to put money down the drain in Africa. Well, we don't put any money into Africa virtually. $2 billion for 750 million people. It's less than $3 per African. And the listeners will be, I think, surprised to know that of that $2 billion, more than half is actually American consultants' salaries. What we're actually giving from our public purse to help Africans buy bed nets to fight malaria, to dig wells for safe drinking water, to build clinics and schools, to hire doctors and nurses in rural areas, it's less than $1 per African per year. So even though Americans are generous and they think that we're doing a lot, we're doing very, very little. Mm. Now, how much should we be doing? We promised in 2002, along with all the rest of the rich countries, that we would make concrete efforts to reach 0.7% of our gross national product. That would be $84 billion a year. Now, here's the irony. What we promised to do and have not done is just about exactly what we're spending in Iraq right now. So rather than saving 8 million lives every year through development assistance, we've gotten into this incredible mess in Iraq, which is incredibly expensive. And then they say, well, there's not money to help poor people.
Let's talk with someone else. The next caller is in the nearby community, Belgium, by Danville, line one. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Ange. Nice to hear you back. Mm-hmm. Hope you enjoy the harness. I would like to ask the question or make the observation that if you even start in Appalachian America or you go to many countries around the world, every place where there's lots of natural resources, there seem to be a lot of poor people. And all that would take to help these people would just be a fair price for their commodity.
Well, there is some of that, but I think it's not quite, unfortunately, it's not a full solution. Where I agree with you completely is that some of the poorest of the poor, for instance, the farmers of West Africa that grow cotton, people living in Burkina Faso, in Mali, in Benin, these are places so poor they never come across the radar screen in this country. They get maybe a half or a third of the price per bushel of cotton that they would if the United States and Europe were not heavily subsidizing our own few thousand cotton growers to the tune of billions of dollars and keeping up artificial trade barriers against what these impoverished farmers could produce. Now, it would make a difference, but they'd still be impoverished, but it would make a difference for them for sure to have fair prices. Unfortunately, trade is not enough. Fair trade, which we should be championing and all too often do not champion, would help, but it wouldn't solve the problem because the poorest of the poor are hardly in international trade to begin with. They're living in isolation. They're living at subsistence. They have very little to market. They're essentially living by growing their own food, collecting their own water, collecting their own fuel wood, living without benefit of roads, power, transport. And so they need help in those three areas of investment that I mentioned earlier, in people, in the environment, and in infrastructure, even if there were a more open trade.
In these same areas, aren't there usually people in very advantageous positions that make all the money that does come into the countries?
Actually, not so much, because if you look at a place like Mali or Chad or Niger or Ethiopia, there's very little income to begin with. The average income level, $100 per year, $200 per year per person, means that even if you distributed everything evenly, the level of wealth is so incredibly low that even the most basic needs cannot be met. So I don't think that these are problems really of exploitation or problems of the rich exploiting the poor. There are those problems. Those are real, as we said right at the beginning of the hour, but I don't think that they're the core explanations of what's happening here. There are places like that, and there are places like our own society where the gap between the richest and the poorest is simply mind-boggling. But here, you could say, yes, there's a huge gap between the richest and the poorest, and I believe the richest should do a lot more in our own society. But that's a society that has an average income of $37,000. In a place where the average income is $200 or $300 per person per year, you can't get that much out of redistribution, obviously.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. We will continue and next talk with someone listening this morning in Urbana, and this is line number two. Hello.
Howdy. Mm-hmm. I would like to challenge the idea that countries, companies, and even individuals actually want to bridge the gaps between the have and have-nots. All of our societies and civilizations through history have been created on the basis of limited distribution. And now, via the Internet, we have the means for unlimited distribution. But you've not seen countries or companies take any major interest for the unlimited distribution of public domain information that could be used to break down the bars of ignorance and illiteracy. Yeah, we did all hear the million-dollar media blitz last December 14th when Google said they had created the most important world-changing technology of electronic books, but not one of those media coverages mentioned that electronic libraries have been part of the Internet since it first got started. There are, you know, over 100,000 freely downloadable electronic books. But with Google, you don't get to keep those books. You only get to read over their shoulder, so to speak. But other than the reactionary French response to Google, there are really no countries that have given lip service to anything remotely resembling a freely available digital library. You know, anybody can create an electronic book, and once they do, everybody in the world can have a copy. But this isn't supported by anybody, including the UN. I was really surprised when I addressed them last year to find out that the World Intellectual Property Organization was a subsidiary of the UN. And then I finally figured out why Ted Turner gave $1 billion to the UN, as he was just paying them back for passing those laws that gave him an extra 20 years of copyright on Gone with the Wind and all that stuff. So I worry that even if we have something that's almost absolutely free, literally too cheap to meter, that we could give to the whole world, and yet we make copyright longer and basically are destroying the public domain. If we won't give them that, which is literally just about free to give, I worry about what happens when you want to give them these billions of dollars you're talking about in material goods.
Well, Dr. Sachs?
It's a very interesting question, a very interesting set of observations. There are, as the caller no doubt knows, because this is a gentleman who knows a lot about this, there are initiatives like the Public Library of Science, which have started a campaign to make scientific information freely available on the Internet to all parts of the world, and I do agree that this can make a big difference. There are funded international institutions that are keeping gene databases in the public sector. This is also extremely important. We need more public sector-based research so that the benefits of this research can get readily to the poorest of the poor rather than being appropriated in patent-protected prices. And the Gates Foundation has been doing a lot of that with Bill Gates is very generous and I think very important donation of $25 billion to start the most significant effort in international public health research addressing the issues of the poorest of the poor.
Can I get something in there?
Yes, sir.
When you talk about the public and the poor, you're talking about making something public that is really of interest mostly to only the scholarly, scientific, ivory tower types.
No, no. Let me give you an example. You know, I've been championing for many years the availability of antiretroviral medicines to people dying of AIDS in Africa. And this has now happened with generic producers producing antiretroviral drugs at what is now 30 cents per dose per day.
Okay, no, sorry, we're talking about different topics here.
Well, no, I'm just
talking about
what scientific advances that are useful for the poorest of the poor.
Right, but I'm talking about what people could read. The poorest of the poor couldn't read that information. Yes, they can get the shots, and that's great, but I'm talking about something by which they could pull themselves up by their own bootstraps.
Well, but of course, the Internet is available for people, and I can tell you this weekend we had a very exciting moment in this village. We're with a laptop computer, which we've donated to the village, and a cell phone. We got the village online for the first time in history. All the children gathered round, absolutely mesmerized by this, and we sent the Secretary General an email message from the village. The first time this very remote area, of course, was ever in this kind of contact. Now you have this wonderful ability with something as simple as a cell phone. And a very inexpensive laptop to start connecting these villages to all of the content on the Internet. And it may not satisfy everything that you or I would want, but it is amazing. And it's a breakthrough that we should and can promote right now. And with some of the, of course, new technologies of local wireless or even the incredibly low costs of broadband through laying fiber optic cables in Africa, we ought to be able to at least close that digital divide in just a few years if we make the effort. Now,
right. We're talking about different things. Talking to the Secretary General is great publicity.
It's not publicity. It's connectivity of a village on the Internet.
But it doesn't give them something for their library. It's just talking to a famous person.
Well, they have no library. They have no books right now.
If they have a cell phone and
no library, it's not just talking. What it is,
they
is
have a
providing
library.
Them with a multi-purpose platform that can help them to know the prices of commodities, that can help them to understand the medium-term weather scenarios, that can help them on email
or
and
they
basic
can download
connection
books.
For their businesses.
They could download books the same way.
Well, you're focusing on one particular thing.
I'm focusing on information, the most basic kind of information.
Okay.
Libraries are a much more basic amount of information than talking with Kofi Annan.
Well, the point was not the specific conversation. The point was the connectivity.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me, but we're into our last 20 minutes here, and I have some other callers I want to include. And also, I think I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus. We're talking with Dr. Jeffrey Sachs. He's director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's also a professor of sustainable development and of health policy and management there at Columbia. He's director of the UN Millennium Project. He's special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the Millennium Development Goals and is well known for advising governments around the world on economic reforms for his work with international agencies to promote poverty reduction, disease control, debt reduction. He has written many articles and many books, and if you're interested in reading on this subject, you might look at his most recent book, which is entitled The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time. It's published by the Penguin Press. We have some other folks here who are waiting and have been waiting patiently, and we'll get on to the next. And this is someone in Champaign and on line number 3. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I like a lot of what you've had to say and also, you know, sort of this idea of what I would think of as a, you know, appropriate technology and bring it down to the level of the individual rather than just huge infrastructure projects, which sometimes don't really aren't as helpful as they are expected to be. And I guess, you know, something that I'd like to discuss is a bit of a reality check on the kind of forces that, you know, the things you'd like to see happen are, you know, are up against. I'm wondering if you're familiar with, I think his name is Martin Perkins' book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and take into consideration the effects of the kind of predatory lending practices that he outlines there and talks about, you know, very specific cases that he was involved in. And then also, very much in conjunction with that, just what is your take on what's going to be the effect of Paul Wolfowitz as the president of the World Bank?
And those are good questions. You know, I'm in this odd position of, on the one hand, being very critical of how these aid institutions have operated in the last quarter century, because I think there have been so many opportunities for them to do things that they have not explained to the public. On the other hand, I'm arguing that we ought to help them to do more. So let me explain. My own view of places like the IMF and the World Bank is that they, instead of being international organizations that represent the fair interests of all of their members, they have been much too much creditor agencies driven largely by the United States, but also the United States and other rich countries. And my view is that this has really compromised the ability of these institutions to carry out their core functions. Essentially, the United States said 25 years ago, we're not going to invest in poor people. They're in a crisis. Well, that's their problem. We're going to tell them to tighten their belts, continue paying their debts. We're going to squeeze them. It was called the structural adjustment era. And that's what the IMF and the World Bank spent a lot of its time doing in the last quarter century. In my view, horrendously so, when they told countries you have to cut back on the size of the health sector, the education sector, a freeze on public sector employment, a decline in public sector employment, when these people needed more nurses, more doctors, more school teachers. Now, I know the professionals in these organizations, and I believe them to be quite professional, but I also know the orders that they're given from the top, essentially from the governing boards of these agencies, and that has come mainly from the United States government. After all, the IMF is at 19th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue, the World Bank at 18th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. It's two blocks down from the White House. It's not surprising where the power really lies. I believe that we need a breakthrough. Obviously, what I'm saying in my book is that business as usual is not sufficient. We need a change of public understanding, a change of awareness, an appreciation of the wonderful things that we could be doing on this planet that would so much aid our own security as well as our humanity, and that this is going to be not business as usual. So we need a breakthrough conceptually. My point is that it's possible. It's possible with awareness. It's possible if the United States public would come to understand better that by investing so much in the military, $500 billion a year now in the military, and only $2 billion in helping Africa, we're not buying security for ourselves. And if we redress that imbalance, then I think it will be possible to get the work done. So in other words, I guess I could be a cynic with the rest of all of us, but I try not to be. I try to look for the positive way forward and believe we have to use our voice and use our shared commitment and use our common sense to break free of what we're doing right now, which is not working.
Well, I don't think that, you know, a fair examination of you know, what has gone on in the past and what the likes of Paul Wolfowitz is likely to bring in the future is cynicism. I think that's just hard-nosed realism and trying to, you know, get at the root of the problem, because I think that, you know, you're going to have a tough time, you know, going up against people like that who are in the position to really control those funds that, you know, you're trying to distribute.
Well, please don't say you. I'd prefer you say you and I are going to have a hard time.
Well, all right. I accept that. It's just that I think that part of what the problem is that people don't understand that our government is a big part of the problem, and that if we don't, really change the policies of the United States, that, this is not going to end because the poverty is not going to end because, part of what our policy is about is ensuring that we have economic dominance over these places. And, to the extent that they can be independent, we're not going to have that. I mean, I agree with Medea Benjamin from Food First that says, the real reason for hunger, the real reason for poverty is a lack of democracy, and that if people, can have real democratic control over their lives, they'll be able to get out of poverty and be able to have enough food.
Could I just add one thought to that? Because I think there's a lot of truth to that. But I would say that what we're discussing right now, this is democracy, and we're having good discussion in public that can change, I hope, or educate or involve more Americans so that we get a more sensible policy for this country. But I would also say that the problem of growing food has a combination of question of democracy, but it also has even a technical point, which is soil nutrients or seed or other basic means to bring more productive agriculture to places that don't have it right now. And I think that technical side's really important also, because I've now seen with my own eyes this past weekend what a sea change can happen in one growing season. In an impoverished community, it can be the difference of extreme hunger and actually breaking out of hunger. And the point is, something as simple as replenishing the nitrogen in the soil can be a breakthrough out of hunger. And I hope that when people hear that and say, oh, well, okay, now here's a practical approach, they will join me and you and others to call on our government to absolutely undertake that, because leaving these people in extreme hunger is not only morally abhorrent, but is dangerous for us. And so I think it's a combination of the voice and the practical approaches that's really key here.
All right, let's talk with someone in Champaign County next, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Since there's a little time, I'd like to just ask about two specific things, and that's the record of the Reagan the administration in terms of this Millennium Challenge thing. Condi Rice was talking about signing an agreement with Madagascar and championing that. But to my mind, and to what I've understood, and that very little has been dispersed, it's really a pretty much of a sham. Maybe there has been some of this market-based money dispersed, but up until just a couple of months ago, nothing had happened. And the other thing, there was some activism, grassroots activism, that I'm sure you were probably involved with, which was there was an attempt to get the Congress on record saying that it opposed structural adjustment policies that had this fee-based for education and for health care, which I guess you could arguably say might be a reasonable approach in the developed world. But when in the lesser developed countries where the poverty is so endemic, this is just basically consigning a lot of people to no health care and no education. And I just wanted you to comment on both of those, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Great questions. Very well informed also. The Millennium Challenge Corporation was announced in March 2002. They, as far as I know, have not dispersed a penny yet for actual programs. They've spent some money on staff. They have approved a couple of programs, so they've committed some funds now, very small scale, $100 million here, $100 million there, in 3 years. It is a terrible thing, actually. The President of the United States stood up 3 years ago and said, we'll put in $1.6 billion the first year, $3.3 billion the second year, $5 billion the third year. That's $10 billion in all. And as far as I know, I may be some weeks out of date, I don't think a penny has gone actually dispersed for a project yet, more than 3 years later. And I've spoken, of course, to the officials in this agency. They explain, well, it's hard to do this, hard to do that, don't blame us. And I said, it's not a matter of blaming you. What it is, though, is a question: how can it be that the United States can spend $300 billion in Iraq during the same interval? We can have two full wars fought, Afghanistan and Iraq, and you can't move basically a penny for the poorest people on the planet? It's a matter of priorities. It is, in my view, really a disgrace. It's a disgrace of a government that puts the priorities on the military and not on peaceful solutions for the most desperate people on the planet. Now, on the other question, user fees for education and health, you had it exactly right. When you charge poor people for access to basic health and education services, they can't afford it. They drop out. And everywhere you go in these villages, in impoverished areas, people are literally dying. Sometimes they're dying in front of my eyes because they can't afford the services. And I mean literally dying in front of my eyes on a stretcher, in a ward, on a floor, in a clinic, because they can't get the services. And these services may be $1.20 for a treatment for malaria, or it might have been $7 for a five-year, long-lasting bed net to fight malaria, but one that they couldn't afford for themselves or for their children. These user fees are horrible. They were, quote-unquote, part of reform, actually, of the World Bank and the IMF. Charge the poor. That's how we're going to balance the budget. And it was horrendous and a failure. But still, these user fees continue, and that's why in the recommendations that I forwarded to the Secretary General this January in the UN Millennium Project, we called for an end to all these user fees. And I'm calling on the G8 leaders also, and I hope they're listening, because we've sent them the message to 10 Downing Street, to Washington, and elsewhere. Drop these user fees. They are nothing but an exclusion of people from the most basic needs to stay alive.
I'll try to get at least one more call in the time we have remaining. This is someone listening in Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
The damage that was wrought by the tsunami brought out an outpouring from the world to address the matter, and the actual amount was filled with surplus donations and so forth, as I heard. Now, those islands and areas that were affected are slowly getting back under their feet, but we have to almost get another word for the horrendous things that are going on in the world that you're addressing regarding poverty. I know former Senator McGovern is addressing the food problem, and other people likewise. But we need a word that's even more impacting than tsunami for the huge areas that's involved. And I don't know, unless they can do something about it, it's like a Titanic for those people. They're just going to go down unless we respond. And as you see, something better occurring. Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, let me tell you what I've been calling it. I've been calling things like the malaria pandemic in Africa a silent tsunami. It's silent. We don't see it. It's not reported in the newspapers. It doesn't come crashing like one horrendous, tragic wave. But it happens every day that 20,000 people are dying of extreme poverty, several thousand every day of malaria, and it goes on predictably, unlike the tsunami. It just goes on every day, day in, day out. Now, to control malaria would cost about $3 billion a year, and this would save more than 1 million lives. All you need bed nets treated with insecticide, keep away the mosquitoes, and you need modern medicines to treat the disease when it hits. And those two interventions would save more than 1 million lives per year. There are 1 billion of us in the rich countries, the United States, Europe, Japan, a few other rich countries, 1 billion people. If we each gave just $3 per year, that would be $3 billion. And that would be enough to save more than 1 million lives. That would address the silent tsunami. Again, I think we have to raise our voice. We have to do it in the churches, in our civic groups, in Rotary International. We have to send our congressmen and senators a letter. What are you doing standing by while so many millions die? Is this really safe for us as well? The answer is no. And I think we're going to have to find more creative ways to make our voice heard, because I don't think Americans want millions of people dying every year on our watch when we could do so much by with such a little effort, in fact.
Well, there we will have to stop. I want to again mention that if you'd like to read more on the subject from our guest, you can look for his most recent book. It's titled The End of Poverty, Economic Possibilities for Our Time, and it's published by the Penguin Press. Our guest, Jeffrey Sachs, is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, where he is also professor of sustainable development and of health policy and management. He's also director of the UN Millennium Project. He is special advisor to the UN Secretary General on the Millennium Development Goals and has, over the last couple of decades, done a lot of work around the world advising governments on economic reforms and dealing with poverty and disease issues. And Dr. Sachs, we want to say to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure to be with you.